Welcome to another episode of the On Coaching Podcast. I'm Steve Magnus, joined as always by my good friend and colleague, John Marcus. John, what's going on, my man?
Steve, you know what it is. We're back. We're here. We're not going anywhere. Why? Because we continue to give the people what they want. Let's go.
That is true. That is what we do. And we've got a fun one in our wheelhouse where we just get to nerd out on the physiology and talk about how that applies to you in your coaching or training world. And this time, you know, we're going to take on something that everybody's talking about.
Zone 2. People are talking about it, but are they actually doing it? That's what we're saying. We're, instead of talking the talk, we're going to walk the walk.
That's right. So Zone 2 training, the science of Zone 2, why it's misunderstood, how to apply it successfully in your training. John, this is a
we're not talking about Zone 1. We're not talking about Zone 3 today. We're only talking about Zone 2. Not one, not three, but two. Okay, let's just be clear.
Only two.
Only
not
two.
The other zones.
Nope.
The other zones can go to hell. We're just Zone 2.
Sometimes, right, though, that's what it feels like in the zeitgeist, where it's just, that's all you hear about. Oh, Zone 2. It's like, well, let's understand it. Let's have it. Let's talk about it. Let's really get an idea about what it is. But you know, it's the hot topic in an endurance world at the moment, but it's always been there and it will always be there.
Yeah, so let's break it down. I mean, I think, you know, actually what helps is maybe understanding why it's in the zeitgeist right now. And I think, you know, it's something that we've talked about for a long time. It's something that we've talked about in our scholar program frequently. But what I like to call it is like the pendulum swinging of training, which is this. If, again, not to plug, but if you're a member of the scholar program and you've gone through the history of training, what do you notice going from all the way back to what we did in the 1800s to today? The pendulum just swings. It swings back and forth. You know, so someone says, oh, today the key is intervals. We're going to do a lot of fast intervals. And then the next generation, 10, 15 years later, says, hey, wait a minute. Whoa, time out. Why are you doing all those intervals? We need to run longer and steady. And then it switches back. And you see this throughout history, right? You see this with the flying fins and then the Gerstler, you know, 200s. And then you see it with Zatopek in the 400s, which comes back after, you know, then we go to more of the kind of Lydiard-esque in the 60s of long. And then from Lydiard, we have this backlash in the 80s where we bring about VO2 max and Sebastian Coe's, you know, 5-tier system where there's more interval stuff. And then we come back in the 2000s and 2010s of high volume. Look at the East Africans, and we just bounce back and forth. And now we're in one of those periods. And again, it's not as clear cut, but in the mainstream, not in the distance world, the same thing occurs. Because what was going on while John and I were going through college and understanding the exercise science hit high intensity interval training very big in the 2010s. Well, what happens after that? Again, in the kind of popular exercise science world, well, we go to the other side. Zone two. So I just want to lay that out, and then I'll turn it over to you, because I think it's important to also say it's not that any of these things are bad or that we shouldn't do zone two or HIIT training or what happens. The point is we just swing the pendulum to like emphasizing something. And then, you know, a decade or so later, we say, wait a minute. No, the magic, the goose is over on this other side. Let's swing to the other side.
Yeah. You know, Steve, you're spot on, right? Like when we talks about swinging the pendulum, it's, you know, essentially over-centrating, over-focusing on one element of the training recipe and saying this is the key. And, you know, that's, unfortunately, that's not how it works in training, right? If I had to say if anything is the key in training, I would say it's sleep, right? I mean, if you had to say, I have a lot of student athletes or people who come in, hey, coach, how to get better? I go, well, sleep more consistently. and sleep more regularly and don't have, you know, interruptions to your sleep pattern. That's the biggest change agent towards improvement. Now, when we talk about training, design and training stimuli and intensity, what happens, right, is when we get to this over-focusing or misinterpreting of something, like zone two in this example, we tend to devolve into these common mistakes that are symptomatic of that, you know, misinterpretation or focusing. And what we're here to do is talk about those common mistakes in zone two training, and then also provide practical applications of zone two training, because it is an important part of the recipe, without a doubt, for endurance athletes. But we must understand it and how we err, so that we then know how to apply it successfully, and two, how to calibrate in the moment and pivot should things go a little haywire or south, or we do not get the reaction we want.
Absolutely. All right. So let's break it down. If we look at zone two, what is it? I'm going to do simple terms and then science terms. Okay. Simple terms, relatively easy, but not zone one, which is really easy, recovery, et cetera. Relatively easy to steady-ish, but not tempo, not threshold. So that kind of what we call like everyday kind of distance run pace, essentially, is what we're looking at. If we look at the science, again, depending on where you go, because there's all sorts of definitions, but we're looking at somewhere between 60 to 75%-ish heart rate max. And then if we're looking at other things, we're looking at, you know, a space where we're primarily burning fat. You know, we're still burning carbs, but we're kind of maximizing that kind of fat utilization to a degree. Again, we can define it in a whole heck of a lot of one other place. Lactate, if you love lactate, again, it's going to vary a little bit, but we're looking at between 1 point something to 2 point something is where we're looking at, again, below that threshold before we get to that 3-4 millimoles where we start seeing steady lactate increases. And that's kind of it. Like when we look at it, is we kind of hype it up to be this big thing, but it's, again, we can look at some of the science, but it's like that steady distance running pace that we're so familiar with.
Right. And let's pinpoint the science on it. The entire point of zone two training and why it is a, you know, valuable part of the training recipe for any endurance athlete, you know, hinges on enhancing mitochondrial content and function, right? So the amount of mitochondria in the body and the quality or the efficacy of its functioning. The reason we use lactate, right, as a proxy for measuring zone two is that number, you know, it's important to not over-focus on the number, but interpret what the number means. That 1.2 millimoles of lactate that's expressed, that is kind of the homeostatic happy space where you have just enough little itty bitty bit of, say, the anaerobic, as we call it, energy system running, but not too much, because you have the, you know, aerobic system running more powerfully with the fat utilization, et cetera. But the body is able to recycle that amount of not just lactate as fuel, but also the metabolic byproducts that are associated with lactate expression through the anaerobic, energy system, and recycle it locally to then build efficacy and build enhanced mitochondrial function. So that's why we use lactate as one of the inputs. That's why we also can use heart rate as one of the inputs. That's why we can also use the talk test as one of the inputs, right? But it's important to understand, like, zone two can't be determined solely by, like, say, power output or heart rate alone. You have to look at it as holistic based on multiple inputs. And I think that's what makes it so hard, because people say, okay, we're just going to look at lactate only, or we're just going to look at heart rate only, or we're just going to look at talk test only. Well, zone two at, you know, 0 feet elevation in the middle of spring when everything is blooming, right, is different than zone two at 0 feet elevation in a dry desert climate where there's no pollens in the air, right? The pollens in the air are going to make it harder to breathe. You know, also zone two at 7,000 feet elevation is not the same heart rate, right, expression as it might be at 0 feet elevation because, again, of the lack of oxygen. So we have to understand it's a holistic interpretation so we know where we are on that spectrum of intensity and the, you know, expressions, the physiological expressions or practical expressions when the athlete's actually performing work.
That's such a good point. And I'm going to hammer that home with my own experience of training in Houston, Texas. You mentioned altitude. I'll mention heat and humidity. If I was to go by the classic heart rate zones for zone two, you know, John, there would be some days where I would be walking, like literally, because cardiac drift and some other things that happen as your body's trying to cool. What happens? I go out for an easy run, even if I'm in the peak shape and I'm running, you know, really, we'll say it, slowish 7 minute mile pace. My heart rate's just going to go up and up and up and up. And towards the end of that hour run or 90 minute run or whatever it is, it's going to be in zone three or sometimes zone four, just based on that drift. Even though I'm going slow, even though I'm going easy, even though if I took my lactate levels, they would be very, very low, right? Why? Because the heart stress is not necessarily on the muscle. There is some. The heat stress is not necessarily on the muscle, although there are some. It's mainly dissipating heat, right? Which we could go down that rabbit hole, but we won't. So anyways there. So we've got to look at the constellation of things. Now, that doesn't mean that you necessarily have to like measure lactate and do all this fancy stuff to do it, but it's looking at the constellation. It's saying on that hot run, like, is my breathing still under control? Can I still, you know, do the talk test, et cetera, et cetera? Like those, how do I feel? Do I feel pretty good doing this? Could I keep going for a while? Like that matters. I think in the same thing, even if we measured lactate, occasionally that can be off too with heat, humidity, could be with eating, could be with pacing. If anybody's ever done a lactate test, they know that small variations in things can cause big downstream things. That's why often we do it in a controlled environment, like on a treadmill. So even lactate can give us some kind of false readings or tell us we're in the wrong spot. So I think that's really important there is that constellation is don't get caught up on, oh man, I'm not running this in this heart rate zone or this pace exactly. Like it just depends on the context and you've got to take that into consideration in order to know like, hey, are you in a good spot or not?
Yeah. I mean, it's important that we hammer and really, really emphasize this point, right? Igo Samalan, who is a cancer researcher and former cyclist out of University of Colorado Boulder, who also consults with the Tour de France, a champion in cycling, kind of invented, right, what we, or really, I should say, highlighted and elevated in the endurance community, this what we call zone two training. And he also coined the term metabolic flexibility. So with the concept of metabolic flexibility, so too should your application of this be flexible given the external conditions and internal conditions of the athlete that they find themselves in, right? And that's why the rigidity with zone two fundamentally does not work because every day is a little different. But having a good, you know, GPS, so to speak, about how to help teach athletes and teach, in this case, runners to land in that zone two spot on a day-to-day basis is really important. And so when we understand that, then we can really, really have good production with it. So, the science of it, right? Just, to close the chapter on this part of the podcast is at the zone two exercise intensity, right? We keep the glycolytic flux relatively low. So when you're doing flux training, right, that's not zone two, even though you may be in zone two for a period of like, say, a down stroke or down flux or a recovery period between, the flux session, you're not in zone two, because zone five and zone two are actually, right, the highest intensity zenith, like, you know, purely anaerobic, like all the way sprinting your buns off, all out quarter, right? And zone two actually creates conflict because it creates a missignaling. So in the body is always going to adapt in the direction of the highest severity. So if you're going to do zone five and zone two training, go, okay, I'm going to do all out repeat quarters at, you know, 1 mile, 800 meter pace with 3 minutes recovery. And then I'm going to do, you know, a 3 mile tempo run, you know, at zone two, really easy, this and that. So I can, you know, kind of like hijack the maximum training effect in dose in a day. Well, it's just like when we lift and do a long run, whatever is the most severe is going to get the most attention. And in that lift and long run example, the long run's the most severe because of the duration of it, will get the most attention. In this example, the quarters at 800 meter pace in zone five, so to speak, at that really high intensity and above will get the most attention. And you won't get the same mitochondrial benefit or boost. And it's important to understand too, you'll get some mitochondrial benefit or boost, but what we found and what the science has demonstrated at zone two is this is where it's maximal beneficial, maximal signaling, right? We're talking about a big, big, big bump, not just a bump, because the body will always adapt, you know, to all the stimuli, but it's about the rate or level of adaptation if we have a high enough signal. So I just want to put that out there because, again, you might look at it overall. Let's say if you're looking at heart rate, right, and looking at flux training, and the heart rate will oscillate in whatever type of flux style workout you might have, or, you know, fartlek or what have you. And maybe the average heart rate will be like in zone two or the higher end zone two, and you'd be like, okay, great, we got a zone. No, that's not how it works, right? So when we understand that, because the, you know, what we're doing, right, is we're trying to stress the oxidative capacity and stimulate, right, at a, you know, cellular level, right, oxidative phosphorylation. And that scientific term is essentially the thing that spurs mitochondrial biogenesis and improved efficacy and density and quality, and helps to mobilize the highest amount of fat uses as fuel over, say, glucose. But, you know, you are still burning a good amount of glucose concurrent with the fat, but it's a higher percentage of fat in the fueling profile. So all that stuff is really important to remember about how to apply it and how to misapply it, because I think that's where we sometimes go astray, is we try to get a concurrent bump, this idea, okay, I'm going to get this zone five intense thing and zone two and just mash it together, because hard day is hard, right? Hard day is hard. And so we'll just get all the stimulus on one day and then we'll make it really easy next couple of days and we'll get better. And yeah, to a certain degree, but it won't be as high of a bump as if you kind of separated things out.
All right. Yeah. So I want to dive in on a couple things you said there that I think are important to kind of highlight and pick apart is, first, kind of the nuance here. When we talk about the zones, I think it's really important here to think of, as John kind of mentioned, is, and there's a wonderful graph that Steven Seiler shared on Twitter as part of one of his presentations he gives, which essentially says, you know, the peripheral adaptations, which are the muscular mitochondrial, he has this wonderful thing that shows that, you know, essentially the widest part, meaning like the biggest bang for your buck, is in that kind of zone two area. But then there's a tail on either side, right? Meaning even if we run slower or faster, we're still getting some of those benefits. And I think that's really important, because it's not an on-off switch, right? It's not like, oh, I'm in this exact zone, now I'm doing this, now I go a little bit harder and that's off. That's not how it works. It's the stress is a stress. But what we know is there's specific intensities or areas that, you know, maximize that stress, which have the adaptation. We could look at the same in terms of hard interval training, right? So if we want to increase buffering capacity, right, lactate, hydrogen ion, buffering capacity, get some tolerance, we have to know that we have to go pretty dang hard, right? We might do fast intervals, you know, where we're cooking, and not a ton of rest, and it's gonna eventually accumulate. Now, if we went a little bit slower and said, let's say we did our intervals at, instead 226, we did them at 28 and didn't go to the well, would we still get some hydrogen ion buffering capacity? Absolutely. But would we get as much? No. And that's okay. Like, some workouts, we might not want to maximize that stimulus because, like, or that stress because, like, that's not the plan. We don't want to push that overload. We just want enough of a dose to kind of get better a little bit, right? Same thing applies to this kind of zone 1, 2, 3, et cetera, is even when we're running easy, we're getting some of these benefits, or slower, we're getting some of these benefits. We're just not, we'll say it, optimizing the stress to get that adaptation as we would. The other thing I want to point out too is, as well, is that we use zones to categorize. Meaning, what I mean there is, especially for zone 1, 2, the division line is kind of arbitrary, right? We say it's at this heart rate or this pace or what have you. But as John and I said, like, heat, humidity, all that stuff, but also on the day-to-day variation, and also in terms of, like, we don't really know what a dividing line is. Because, you know, there's even dividing lines like the lactate threshold, where we say, ah, this is the line. That line, you know, as John knows, like, that line can vary based on how we test it. You know, so that line, you know, might be 450 mile pace. It might be 505 mile pace. It kind of depends on how we test it in the day to day. So I just want to put that there, because I think one of the misconceptions here is like, okay, I got to be in zone 2. And if I go over zone 2, I've screwed everything up. Or if I don't go, is there's a lot of wiggle room in here, because, like, we're making our somewhat arbitrary distinctions to help us categorize the training better. Not necessarily because there's a physiological, like, on-off switch that occurs.
Right. This isn't like, say, action potentials, where it's, you know, yeah, all or nothing. You know, like, I read somewhere, you know, out in the ether from actually, a writer and a voice in the endurance community who coaches people, who said, you know, like, either you're in zone 2 or you're in zone 1 and that's it, right? And I had an athlete I was coaching and they ran 9:55. for the mile pace, and that was too intense, like, because I wanted to run 10 minutes for, you know, the recovery run. And it's like, stop. stop feeding people junk. That's not true. The, you know, because remember too, like, the important thing about zone 2 training, and, you know, we, like, say, and we have proxies, we've seen it throughout the course of history, right? When we look at, like, oh, the Kenyan runners, they run so slow, it's poly-poly, oh my gosh, it's so slow, look how slow, you gotta run slow to run fast. Well, yeah, they're running really slow, and they're in zone 2, but they're at 7,000-8,000 feet elevation. So you can run that slow, because the idea behind zone 2, right, is to minimize the amount of breakdown to the structural tissue, soft tissue, right? The amount of breakdown to the muscle belly, the amount of extraction of glucose, right, from the glycogen stores in the muscle belly. It's to have that be the smallest amount possible while maximizing to the highest degree the mitochondrial signaling and benefit, right? So at 7,000-8,000 feet elevation, yeah, you can run 9-minute pace because checks the boxes, right? We're not breaking down muscle tissue because it's not a high structural load. You know, it's not that high, you know, demand on the tissue. 2, where it checks the R box, we're not extracting a lot of, you know, stored glucose or glycogen from the muscle belly. Boom. So in, you know, we're burning more fat. 3, passes the talk test, right? You're talking. It's not a big deal. You know, a little bit elevated labor breath, but you're still talking. Great. Hits all the boxes. Then taking that and applying it to sea level athletes, right? And like, why isn't this working? Why isn't this working? Because we're running super duper slow. Well, again, the same, like we talked about before, external pressure of altitude is not there. So it might be at sea level, maybe it's 7:30 pace, right? For a male distance runner. And so it's just understanding that too, also as you spend more time running in general, or doing any kind of, you know, physical activity at that 15-minute threshold, even if it's super easy, cardiac drift starts to induce itself, right? We start to, you know, we lose hydration in the body, because now we're trying to cool the skin, you know, cool the surface area. So another example, right? Say someone like myself, 6 foot, 170 pounds, a lot of muscle on me, a lot of surface area on my skin to cool. 50 minutes run in my zone one might be like the threshold and the maximum I can get, like, you know, extract as much benefit as possible, versus like, say my wife, 105 pounds and 5'2", smaller, more petite, way less muscle, way less surface area to cool during activity. She might be able to go like 90 minutes, right? And get this, be able to prolong her exposure in zone two, simply because her genetic makeup and her talent physically is different than mine. Like, you don't see a lot of 6 foot, you know, buck 50 in, you know, marathon runners, right? Chris Zelensky was a failed marathon runner, because part of the talent of marathon running is you have to have a really small surface area on your skin, so being short, to cool. But he was a rock star 5K, 10K runner, because that was more of a power output endurance activity. So when we look at this, we also have to look at the person too. And one of the other common mistakes, right, is just saying, all right, everyone goes for the same time for the easy run in zone two. And it's like, no, for beginners, half hour is enough. Half hour, and that's what most of us work with is beginners. That's perfect, right? All my recovery runs, everyone's recovery run is between 30 minutes to 50 minutes, because that's the optimal period for people to self-select their time in that restoration exposure, but also to zone two exposure. Now, for more highly trained athletes or more seasoned athletes who have high mitochondrial density in general, well, their lactate threshold, right? So now the opposite side of the spectrum, the opposite side of the constellation at the highest level, like, it might, their lactate threshold might not be the average 4 millimole. It might be 8 millimole. It might be 7 millimole. We know this. So there's where their zone two starts from a lactate measuring standpoint might not be at 1 or 2, might be ticking up a little bit higher. So they have to go, you know, if, especially if you're a cyclist, they might have to go 2 or 3 hours in that, you know, exposure zone to get the benefit, just because the mitochondrial content and quality is so high. So it changes as well the requirement based on the training history and age and relative efficacy of the athlete you're coaching. So extracting what, say, the Inga Britsons are doing, or extracting what this Ethiopian athlete is doing, or extracting like what, you know, this cohort of middle distance runners who are world-class professional in the United States, and then applying it to your high school athletes or your online client, you know, coaching clientele who's just trying to break 4 hours for the marathon, or even applying it to a lot of collegiate athletes, just copy and paste doesn't work.
Absolutely. And I'm going to nerd out on the science a little bit to explain part of this as well, because I think this is important. Part of that is because, think about it like this, okay? We apply the stimulus, we get an adaptation. But, you know, and the dose makes the poison. But a lot of that depends on what is actually a stimulus for you, right? And as you just outlined there, John, is like, what's the stimulus to adapt for the Ingebrigtsens is going to be different from even you or I, okay? So our training level differs. Our training background differs. This is why, you know, if I take someone who came from, I don't know, a high intensity, a very intense, not a lot of volume training, guess what? Doing a lot of zone two is going to have a different effect, or I should say easy zone two is going to have a different effect than if I take someone who comes to me with a kind of classic Lydiard, you know, high volume space, right? And I should also say where we need to be in these zones will differ. There's a reason that sometimes, and you know, we know this from coaching, there's a reason that sometimes athletes, you know, take their easy runs a little bit easier than other athletes who are of the comparable, you know, speed. The classic is like, do you have the, you know, a really good 5K runner that runs their easy runs at, you know, 6:40 pace or 5:40 pace? And we've seen success in both ways. Now, both those athletes, the reason is pretty simple, is because they're applying a stress that they need to adapt to. And because of their training background, their individual physiology, like they need a slightly different stress. And we can see this. I'll use the classic example is take the middle distance runner. You know, do you know why a 1500 runner who's more kind of 800 based and does some volume, they often have to run slower, because if they run too fast, they start dipping into kind of their fast twitch reserve, you know, fibers to utilize them, because they don't have as many or robust as like slow twitch fibers and the mitochondrial density behind that. So if we run too fast, we're applying a different stimulus, even though in the grand scheme of things, it might be a quote unquote slow pace for them. So there's variation in here. And then the other thing I really want to point out here is if you look at the science, so we said mitochondrial biogenesis, like we want to create mitochondria. How do we do that? Well, the science is very clear that there are many pathways to do that. This is why even if we do, or if we do flux training, we still get mitochondrial development. Why? I'm gonna simplify it here, but if you look at low intensity, you know, stuff, what does that do? It activates this pathway called the calcium comodulin pathway, which is essentially what happens in the cell. We get increased calcium, and the body goes, oh crap, like we've got to deal with this. Well, what happens, that calcium comodulin pathway is activated and eventually triggers what we call PGC1 alpha, which eventually leads to mitochondria creation, development. But on the opposite side, okay, if we do high intensity, short duration stuff, so 200s that are pretty quick with, you know, not a lot of rest, guess what? It's not the calcium that signals it, but we have this ATP, ADP, AMP balance, essentially. And that gets thrown off. And guess what? That activates AMPK. You don't need to, this isn't going to be a quiz. But you know what, you know what AMPK does? It activates PGC1 alpha and creates mitochondria. Through a different pathway, we get to the same, you know, endpoint, which is mitochondria creation. And this is why, again, we have many more pathways than this, but these are just two simple ones I remember from long ago in grad school. But like these things end in the same way, but the trigger, because what increases calcium in the cell is different than what throws off our kind of ATP ratio in the cell. And this is, again, why, like, and if we look at, if we were to talk about it in zone two, what would zone two do? It'd be that calcium. We'd get a gradual increase of calcium so that long duration stuff, low intensity stuff would say, hey, we need more AMPK. Now we could go down a long path here, but what kind of research tells us and what we know is that sometimes these are like quick adaptations and sometimes they're slow. And generally, the low intensity zone two, or what I call slow adaptations, means like we need to be there a lot in order to, like, you know, get this end result of mitochondria. We gotta be there a lot. And the high intensity stuff is we're going to get some mitochondria, but it's like we don't need to be there a ton. We do it and our body goes, oh shit, like let's activate. But then we're kind of tapped out a little bit because a lot of this occurs in more fast twitch orientated fibers. So it's kind of like, okay, what we do know is like fast twitch fibers develop mitochondria, but they're not as receptive or easy to develop as the slow twitch fibers. So, all right, I'll pause there, step back, but there's science and understanding to, you know, why these things occur the way they do.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Steve, because it just, you know, reinforces the reality that when we think about the term flexibility, the body is very flexible and it has multiple pathways because we've been exposed through evolution to multiple physical demands and we had to find a solution to, quote unquote, basically staying alive through fueling the body through different demands, right? Whether it's the quick, fast, you know, avoid getting eaten and being prey, or the quick, fast pivots, turns to like get our prey to eat, or whether it was the long sojourns that we had to take through hunting and gathering, where it's like, all right, got to go to this area that's bearing fruit. And then I got to spend 2 hours like walking, running over to this area that's bearing fruit to kind of find, you know, nutrients for survival. So the human body's robustness, right? Our talent, if you will, our evolutionary talent is we are really good adapters and really fast adapters. And we're very flexible adapters. We can never forget that. But when we talk about, you know, I want to, you know, reemphasize a point you said with zone two, being there a lot means a lot of volume, a lot of time spent in zone two to get the signaling and effect that we want. So this is why quote unquote high mileage works and can work if you're in zone two a lot, but the intensity of that high mileage is relatively low, but in the zone two spectrum versus flux training or more higher intensity work works as well because the doses are, you know, not as frequent, but they're very severe in their signaling to say, hey, hurry up and adapt lickety split. But you need a longer period of restoration or recovery or repair to follow it. And so when you hear about zone two training in the zeitgeist and a recommendation of, oh yeah, do this. Well, you're met with demands in training, right? You might have constraints versus the athlete you're training might not have the ability to say run for 2 to 3 hours a day, you know, in doubles or triples, or even in a single bout, because you physically don't have that time for practice. They're a student athlete with a lot of demands. Like when I was coaching in high school, right, we had 90 minutes, 30 of those minutes was taken up by team meetings and team warmups every day. So now you have 60 minutes to administer a workout before the kids have to go home. Well, it's going to be pretty tough to do a lot of zone two training in that period of time. And plus our off-campus running was not that good. It was basically like straight uphill or straight downhill anytime you stepped off the track, you know, at the environment I was in. So you had to find a different way to administer these stimuli. And that's where flux training comes in because, again, it's a different way to administer it. But the structural breakdown with the higher intensity mitochondrial inducing work like flux training is a lot higher and demands a lot more repair time versus the structural breakdown to the tissues with zone two is a lot less and requires less breakdown. And that's why it's favored in the media at the moment, is because you can do the most of it and repeat it with high frequency and high volume without having a lot of physical structure down, breakdown to the tissues. But you know what else is another doctored way, in a really intelligent way, that induced kind of this zone two training, that if there is a, you know, kind of best of both worlds approach of kind of higher movement, higher frequency of movement, higher intensity of movement relative to also with a little bit of low intensity of movement, fresh runs, right? Fresh runs were essentially what Igloy figured out and Bob Shule of saying, I'm going to run 100 meters, roughly 20 seconds at 3K pace. I'm going to stop, walk, turn around for 20 seconds, right? So basic brings the heart rate down, brings everything down, and then do it again, back and forth. So 20 seconds on, 20 seconds literally off, literally just walking. And so the heart rate starts to oscillate, but you also get these injections of higher motor output with the neurological demand of running 3K pace. And overall, if you watch this, like, you know, you'd see any time that, you know, in Shule's training, in what he documented, anytime he was feeling like crap and he just was feeling blah on a workout day, what do you do? He just do like 3 or 4 sets of 20 times fresh runs and call it the day. Because again, all Shule did was have 100-meter grass straightaway that he trained on before he won the, you know, 1964 Olympics 5K, right? I mean, a beautiful adaptation or application of these quote unquote zones and training stimuli to get the adaptation before we knew all the science behind it.
Exactly. And I love that you brought that up because, again, it's a different way to solve the same problem. And get the stimulus needed for adaptation, but in a way that isn't just like the way we traditionally think of kind of this easy zone two, whatever it is by manipulating the workout. So it's 100 meters and a turnaround of not that fast. You get, again, you're running faster. If we were to only go based on pace, you're running faster than zone two, but the stimulus is in that area, right? It's relatively easy to get. So I think that's such an important point. And again, this is why I think when we talk about zone training, I think we need to realize the point is, like, there's different physiological stimuli that we need to get, but we get to create and manipulate the workout to do so in a variety of manners. And it's not just tied to the one thing that it's very popular with, which is zone two is like easy, steady running at the 60 to 70% heart rate. You can also do this in a number of other areas based on if you modulate the thing, right? We could also do this to a degree with various, you know, circuit training. Again, maybe not as specific, but to a degree, you could get the same effect. So what you've seen in past with different coaches and athletes who have done that to a good degree.
Yeah, I mean, when we were talking about training endurance athletes or middle distance to distance runners, top of mind when writing training is just saying, okay, how am I going to administer a dosage or a stimulus or medicine, so to speak, that will spur mitochondrial biogenesis? How am I going to do that? And why am I going to do it in this? And then you ask, why am I going to do it through this route or this path? Could be long, slow, very easy running. Could be some type of intelligent flux type session. Could be high intensity interval training. Could be circuits, right? Russian intervals, like we talked about before, where there's some type of power output activity that's more general and then a running output activity that's more specific and oscillating between that. Always, 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 we are trying to, the one thing that the science is very clear on, right, is the goal is, again, the highest possible volume, yes, but first and foremost, frequency, the highest possible frequency that you can successfully interpret, successfully absorb without creating overtraining, under recovery, and structural breakdown. I was having this conversation actually, you know, serendipitously with my wife, who's in the master runners now. She goes, how'd you ever, you know, get me to like run under like, you know, 16 minutes for 5K in the pre-super shoe era? Cause, you know, aging body, you know, a lot of more adult demands on our time than say 5, 6, 7 years ago, you know, when you're a little younger, a little less in roles of oversight professionally. And, you know, I just looked at her, I said, it was very simple. Like, remember what you did like every day during the weekday when you go to work, you'd get up at 5 a.m. and do an easy shakeout run of 30 to 50 minutes. Cause I know, cause I got up with you. And then you'd run at lunch for, you know, another 30 to 50 minutes at lunch. And then you would come home and we do in the evening, like a skills and drills session or a lift on your quote unquote easy days. On the workout days, it would be, you know, again, an easy shakeout run in the morning and then a workout and then maybe a lift or not a lift. Right. And I go, look at the frequency of that. Once to twice a day, every 4 to 6 hours, you're getting a little bit of a stimulus and a bump and a hit towards the enzymatic signaling of PGC1 alpha, right? Through those different pathways that Steve explained. Well, the frequency of that over time spurs enhanced mitochondrial biogenesis, and all of a sudden your quote unquote aerobic capacity goes through the roof because very frequent in that dosage. When I was in high school, and like Steve was in high school, Steve doubled a bunch. I doubled a bunch, right? I'd go and I'd run in the morning or even a spin on the bike, the stationary bike for 30 minutes to 50 minutes in the morning. And then boom, go to school all day and then do track practice or cross country practice in the afternoon. Again, looking back on it, the frequency of exposure also create a higher volume of exposure, a higher, you know, a more consistent signaling. So yeah, mitochondria went through the roof because as we know with a lot of things in life and mitochondria as well, it's a use it or lose it phenomena. And if you're not signaling it daily or near daily, you're going to start to lose it and you're just going to start to go downhill.
Exactly. I'm glad you brought that up because frequency plays a big role here that I think often we're missed. Because, you know, it's the old singles versus doubles debate. But what we know is that frequency matters a lot because especially in this, in the lower intensity kind of zones because it's like sending that signal multiple times where it's like, okay, we've got to adapt. And it's also why if you look at Lydiard's athletes, yes, they had the long single, but many of them, especially at the high level, had an easy shakeout double run in the morning as well. That's why if you see Igloi, what does his athletes do? Although he's not doing doubles in terms of, you know, just easy running, he's doing doubles in terms of manipulating the intervals. There's easy sessions often back to back.
Well, and we have documentation of Igloi, some Igloi athletes doing 90-minute easy in the morning. And then coming back and doing interval sessions, like, you know, flux sessions in the afternoon. Again, boom, there you go.
Yeah, so I think a lot of times is the way I like to look at it is get the frequency up. And I think sometimes we don't because it's like easier to try to, you know, do the single and be like, okay, I'm done for the day. But if we can get that frequency up, we're gonna benefit. And it also can serve kind of a recovery standpoint as well, as if you're doing, and this was what Igloi noted. And I remember in the scholar course, we talked about this is he had this idea where he said, well, if I can kind of make it a 60-40 split where I go 60% of the workout in the morning and 40% in the afternoon or vice versa, I'm going to get bigger bang for my buck. Instead of doing it all at once on the track. And I think the same is true with just about everything. So if we can get that frequency up instead of just focusing on the intensity or the raw volume, I think we're going to be better off as well.
Yeah, I mean, and the documentation on the efficacy and potency of frequency, you know, is out there in the training literature and also too in the arc of history. If we look at David Rudisha's junior training as a junior, he was pulling triples three times a day as a junior. So here everyone's like, he came out of nowhere, but I don't know, if you spend your formative years age like 13 through 18 doing near triples of activity almost, you know, without interruption, all of a sudden you're going to be a monster like he was, right? And that's always the reality is, you know, the old idea of farm strength is essentially that, you know, if you look at a farmer's schedule, they'd wake up in the morning, eat breakfast, work, then take a break, right? Eat some lunch, work, take like another like little break and then work. Like, you know, you're pulling long triples or long doubles here. And we know too the importance of mitochondrial health and zone 2 health. And another reason why it's so popular in the zeitgeist at the moment is it is a very important internal stimulus to combat a lot of different cancers. And that's where, you know, Saint Malan spent a lot of his time was saying, oh, this mitochondrial stuff helps to, you know, helps to ward off or reverse some cancers. But then too, he, being a former cyclist, he's like, oh, it also has application to sport, which is, again, you know, it's a virtuous cycle here in why physical activity and frequency of physical activity is so important to our health, because that's how we're hardwired. That's how we evolve. It's in our DNA.
All right. So let's sum things up for the listener coach. Is zone two is important, but don't get caught up on thinking it's a hard and fast, you know, zone with concrete barriers. It's about having that stimulus where it's something relatively easy, something that's aerobic that we repeat frequently, because again, it takes longer to get this adaptation than it does for the you know, shorter intensity stuff. It's the old Lydiard figured this out a long time ago, right? What did he say? We got to have months to build up this long stuff, and then we got to have, you know, a shorter period to sharpen up with the more intense stuff. Why? Because he realized the kind of frequency needed to kind of get to a good place, not quite maximize, but get to a good place in this stuff. If you do that, you're going to be in a good spot. Don't obsess over, you know, any one individual characteristic, as John and I talked about. Use a variety, from talking to heart rate to feeling to experiencing to if you have lactate, whatever you have, but use a variety. Don't get stuck on, oh my gosh, my heart rate is at, you know, 72%. I'm out of the 70% zone. I've got to slow down. It just depends. It depends on where you're at. So don't stress that out. And the other thing I'd say is, like, again, the model here is not to get obsessed on zone two is the be all fix all. It has an important part. It has an important stimulus. We know that. We spent the last, 50 minutes explaining that. But it's one of many ways even to get that same adaptation, that mitochondria primarily. But don't neglect everything else. Don't be the person who swings the pendulum all the way to one side, forgetting everything on the other side. We need some sort of balance. It's what we've known for, 150 years of training is we've been messing with the balance, but we need some sort of balance. There is no magic, training intensity that's going to give us everything.
Yeah. I mean, it always comes back to a constant theme we try to articulate on the podcast here when it comes to training or competing or racing it, or, coaching is balance, right? It's balance, and balance doesn't mean everything in the same proportion, but everything in the correct proportion. So there might be times where, this athlete is going to be that you're working with a marathoner who might spend a lot more time doing zone two training because it's more advantageous for them over the long haul versus this athlete who's an 800 meter specialist who might get that mitochondrial boost through different, pathways like through flux training, but still does spend some days here or there in zone two for them. Right. And that balance is important to make it so we don't overfocus and misinterpret how to apply a kind of, quote unquote, sciency thing like zone two. We have to remember a lot of this stuff and the way the human body is designed is to be, successful when we have specificity in a zip code. So we're specific, but it's not like a street address, right? We're not that specific. And there's a lot of these kind of Trojan horses out there that give a false proxy or false confidence saying, I nailed it right on the nose. Where's my lactate? My lactate's right at this. I'm measuring it every minute of my, of my run. I'm pricking my finger just to make sure. And it's like, or I got my heart rate monitor on as well. Or I got, this, bio omega alpha frequency wave thing to measure. It's like, whoa, 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 chill out, time out. People were wildly successful at this, craft called endurance training or distance running for many a decades when we had none of this stuff. So, but that's where the art in the, of training that comes into it is enhanced through the foundation or understanding of the science, right? And there's been a lot of good coaches, like Frank Daggett is a really good example, of an American coach who was an artist through and through and just implicitly understood how to effectively train middle distance runners. He didn't know science was shit. But now, if you know, and he'd be the first to tell you, but now his artistry is backed by and reinforced by the foundation of science that we have available to us today. So if anything, remember the science of running is meant to stabilize and enhance and elevate and also consolidate your confidence in the art of coaching.
Couldn't have said it better. So there you go. Hope you enjoyed as we dove deep into the science of zone two and how it applies to your life. If you're interested for more of these deep dives, check out the Running Scholar Program. It's our coaching course and community where we have, more information on the history, science, and training for all levels of athletes and coaches. Until next time, everybody, keep on coaching.